Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. Last time, we started to take a look at how the COVID-19 situation in prisons has developed using figures from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And, well, it hasn't gone so well. We knew from the start that the situation would be bad with the lack of hygienic options, the overcrowding, etc., but the numbers are pretty astounding, you know, with a 26.2% positive rate out of the 43,000 incarcerated people tested, which is over 15 times the rate of positive cases in the general population. And so we knew the prisons were going to be pretty terrible environments given the pandemic to begin with. We knew that incarcerated people were statistically more likely to face harsher symptoms from the virus. And we knew that letting nonviolent and low-level offenders out didn't really have a negative effect on their communities, because prisons had, in fact, already started to do this to a small degree, and saw no real increase in crime as a result. But despite all this, prisons reacted woefully inadequately to the situation, to the point where 26.2% of federal prisoners have tested positive for the virus so far. Despite the fact that it is the complete responsibility of those who are managing these prisons, either directly or indirectly, to keep incarcerated people safe. It's not like they have much control over their situation, you know, people who are incarcerated. So really, they're relying on those who are, you know, basically those who have power over them, whether it's people who directly do, people like wardens, prison staff, or people who more indirectly do, which is something like your governor, your legislature, and so on and so forth. They're basically relying on these people to keep them safe, and they're not doing their job. And so despite all these things, the Federal Bureau of Prisons actually had the gall to put out a document called the Correcting Myths and Misinformation about the Bureau of Prisoners and COVID-19 document. And in it, they provided such great corrections to accusations. You know, they said things like, no, people here are safe in prisons because we give surgical masks to staff. You know, no mention of giving them to the incarcerated. Or, you know, they say things like, staff follow strict rules because we provide guidance to them, which has no mention of enforcement. So, essentially, their whole document that's supposed to make them look good says, hey, we do things, but we don't really enforce stuff, so stop yelling at us, and that's just not the way the public health works. There's also the fact that this document just has things that are completely wrong to begin with, like where they say that prisons are safe because they particularly encourage mask usage when social distancing isn't available. But that's not how it's supposed to work. You're supposed to do both. You're supposed to use the mask and social distance. So on top of a complete regimen of incompetence, if not cruelty, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has the gall to pat itself on the back using statements that seem to do anything but shine a good light on them. So with that recap slash rant of last time, let's talk more about the situation as it's developed today in general. So to start, I'll be citing numbers in an article by the Marshall Project, which is constantly updated. As of writing this, the last update itself was actually just about 14 hours ago. And this is called A State-by-State Look at Coronavirus in Prisons. So the number of new cases rose and peaked originally back in early May. But recent, you know, recent meaning since the start of July, recently there's been a pretty terrifying increase in new cases, even on a week-by-week basis. In the original peak, the maximum number of new cases per week was about 6,900. After the week of July 7th, the lowest amount of new cases per week was about 6,600. What I mean by that is there was an early wave that rose and fell, and then right now we're in the middle of another wave. In the first wave, it only got up to 6,900 at its worst. And in the new wave, basically, at the very beginning of the new wave, they had already reached that initial peak that they saw in the first wave. Actually, even just a couple of weeks ago, you had 8,800 new cases being reported. So this is like 30% higher or something than the previous peak. And we still don't know if we're at the peak yet. We're still going. So from this, I think that we should realize at least one thing right away. The crisis began and showed everyone just how bad it could get in prisons. And thankfully, at that time, it abated to some degree. And what this means is that people knew just how bad it could get, because they'd just seen it, but even given that, they didn't care enough to do anything to stave off this current wave, which is shaping up to be much worse than the previous one. And you could always say something like, well, you know, these things will just come in waves, you know, we're seeing waves in the general population as well, but the main difference there is that you don't have that tight of control over what the general population does. You have very tight control over what goes in and out of a prison, as to what the rules are there, as to what the conditions are there. So you don't have the same excuse that a general population might have for getting a second wave. You don't have the excuse of, well, you know, these things will just happen, because you're supposed to make things safer in your facilities that you have control over. And the situation is pretty obviously much worse than being reported in general. So epidemiologists and public health experts said that only a few prisons have actually begun aggressively testing, leading to a large number of COVID-19 cases that are circulating undetected at the moment. And if you know anything about how diseases are spread, you know that undetected cases are the ones that you're really worried about for obvious reasons, right? Like, these people aren't the ones who are being quarantined, they aren't people who are being treated, so they're going to have a higher viral load that they could spread to each other. And when you look at exponential growth rate of infected populations, you'll see a trend that's pretty close to the recent numbers that we've been seeing over this last wave. And this perspective from public health officials backs up this trend as being founded in reality instead of just some kind of statistical noise or anything. If you want to look at the actual numbers, I highly recommend the article. There isn't like a lot of text, so you don't have to like read through too much. There's just the numbers, and if you want to read it, there are sections that can explain the data pretty simply. How it was collected, any corrections they've made to the data, and why they did so. If for nothing else, they present things in a pretty nice graphical format, so if you want to just look at it that way, I'd encourage you to go and do so. But it can be useful just to look at the numbers and get a perspective on the situation in prisons at the moment. So to sum this up, to sum up what I just talked about, we've already got through one wave of the crisis, at least in prisons. So I would then think that given that we have a responsibility for the well-being of those under our power, that prison officials would rectify the situation that caused such a large wave to occur in the first place. Yet now the second wave is coming, meaning that such a significant change did not happen, and it's looking even worse than the first. It's already ramped up past the scale of the first time around, and we should hope that it doesn't get much worse in this regard. The next aspect to examine here, after case rates, which we talked about last time, and the trend in new cases, which is what we just talked about, is the outcomes. You know, basically, how bad exactly has it gotten in prisons in terms of what people are experiencing from this? And the biggest one that people are going to look at and report about is the death rate. So we'll talk about that here, even though I do want to say that death rate is far from the only outcome we should look at. It's just the easiest to report, right? It's a lot harder to say, oh, was this a severe lung complication they're going to deal with the rest of their life, or is it a moderate one? What is severe? What is moderate? But death is death, so it's basically an easy, cheap way to get a look at these numbers. So last time we discussed that per the Federal Bureau of Prisons data, the death rate was somewhere around 1%. But this is pretty limited data and pretty unreliable data, so instead we'll look at an article posted by the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, which cited the publication COVID-19 cases and deaths in federal and state prisons. So just a note on the data here, and you'll hear me say this again, but I'm not saying that this data is particularly great or reliable either, but it is a lot more data than just from the Bureau of Prisons, because I think it combines all state prisons and everything, all jails as well. So first thing I want to know is this article is fairly old. It's from July 8th, when prison case rates were actually around half of what they are now. But the overall analysis in the article is still worth mentioning for two reasons. And one is that, well, it's just a good analysis in general. It's a large amount of data that they're looking at, so you can be fairly confident in what they're saying. And the second thing is that it's worth mentioning because it has gotten much worse since this article was published. So anything you hear now is now realistic, is realistically at the current day much worse than I'm going to say. So anyways, at the time this article was writing, they found that the reported COVID-19 death rates in U.S. prisons overall were about 0.04% versus about 0.03% for death rates in the general population. Again, as to why these figures differ from last time, when I said about 1%, the authors themselves actually said that their data set vastly underestimated the true numbers because prisons at this time were either not reporting cases or not testing prisoners at all. So anyways, with that having been said, the death rate for prisoners was about 50% higher than the general population, which is pretty bad to start with. But the thing is, the prison population is not representative of the general one in many regards, and one that's especially relevant to the virus's age. People age 65 and older make up 81% of overall U.S. coronavirus deaths, but are actually present in prisons at a 6 times lower rate. So in terms of numbers that actually make sense, only about 3% of those incarcerated are 65 or older, but 16% of those outside prisons are 65 or older. So when the authors adjusted for this difference in population makeup, along with some other minor things like gender and so on, they found that the death rate for incarcerated people was actually 3 times higher than those outside of prisons. So in a situation with a great amount of control over who gets in and out, over what gets in and out, over whatever rules are there, prison officials still ended up with a 3 times death rate overall. And I think that Brendan Saliner of the JHU School of Public Health said it pretty succinctly when he said, "Prisoners have a right to adequate protection of their health while incarcerated. We aren't coming anywhere close to meeting their basic needs." And so if you don't want to take it from me, take it from someone who knows way more about what they're talking about. Well, you might say, you know, this is bad and all, but realistically, there are bigger things for me to worry about right now. I'm worried about how this could affect me and my family. I don't have time to worry about people who are incarcerated. Well, then you might be interested in what Kelsey Kaufman talked about in her article, "Why Jails Are Key to Flattening the Curve of Coronavirus," which was written some months back, but which epidemiological principles still apply. You know, what I'm saying is the science still applies. It's not like the science behind it, her reasoning has changed. And it might even apply even more so now, given the size of this wave of cases. So the point that Kaufman made was this. Local jails are essentially revolving doors. And what that means is as people are moved into densely populated areas, they're usually there for just enough time to get infected by the virus and then are released, either for trial, to get it on bail, etc. So these areas essentially act as huge amplifiers of the virus, meaning that you can have a huge increase in cases locally stemming from everyone basically going into this one area and getting infected. You can have outbreaks in your entire community stemming just from people who are going into jails and out of jails, who are being held in jails and then released like 3 days later, things like that. And sending people to jail during this time for things like technical violations might seem incredibly stupid, but that doesn't stop probation and parole officers from doing so. Many people who are out on parole can, and have, been sent back to jail because of things as silly as failing to pay a fine, losing their job, which is, you know, given the current scenario, applying to a lot of people, or missing curfew. Furthermore, even if they choose not, even if these parole officers and probation officers decided, no, I don't want to stop giving out these violations, courts themselves could actually release nonviolent offenders and decrease the number of people who were sent there in the first place. This is actually well-defined in their limits of power. They wouldn't have to wait for this, any kind of outside approval to do so. So they could just act on their own. And so on this note, in general, we can look at other ways that the criminal justice system could be working to reduce the amount of cases in prisons. So for that, I'll turn to an article from the Prison Policy Institute, or PPI. They begin by suggesting the same things we talked about in jails. You know, don't send so many people there to begin with, and release more as well. They also further extend the point of reducing admissions additionally by refusing any admissions at all for technical violations of probation and parole rules. And this is a bit different than what I just talked about, because they're not just saying that technical violations should not be given out. They're saying that any courts that see there's a technical violation for this individual, they should say, no, we're not admitting them to jail, or the jail should do it themselves. So this is saying should refuse admissions outright for such, you know, minor things. Furthermore, the PPI actually gives a great set of comprehensive guidelines on what populations should be released from prisons at the current time and what mechanisms by which prison officials should do so. For example, populations that they believe should be immediately considered for release are people nearing the end of their sentence, as 600,000 people are released from prisons each year, so why not commute the sentences of people who are going to be out in a few months anyways? Another population is those in minimum security facilities and those who are on work release. Essentially, people who have proven that they are not exactly a threat to the rest of society and who are working hard to function within it. The next category is people who are medically fragile or older individuals. Prisons actually hold a large amount of people who have, quote, chronic illnesses and complex medical needs, and what this means is that there's a much higher rate of severe complications from the virus in these individuals. And finally, as you'd probably expect, and as you've heard a lot of times, they should release anyone who's there for what's considered a minor offense, or anyone who has a low likelihood of committing another serious offense. So essentially, the obvious part of this is nonviolent offenders who should be released. The less obvious part is people who might have committed a serious offense, but who are actually assessed as being very unlikely to commit another serious offense if released. For an example of this, you can think of let's say someone was arrested for killing someone else who, I don't know, wronged their family. I'm coming up with kind of a weird scenario here, I realize that, but my point here is, let's say that there was someone who committed a serious offense for a very specific scenario. You know, like, let's say they robbed a specific person because that person had done something to them, something like that. Well, after they've served the majority of their sentence, someone would probably assess them, a prison psychologist or whoever, and say, no, they're very unlikely to do this again. It was serious, but it's very unlikely that they do this again. This was a very specific scenario. Well, these kind of people are probably a good population to release as well, given that there isn't really going to be that big of, there isn't really going to be a negative effect from doing so. These people were spurred on by, like, a really specific situation, for example. So it's not like they just commit this crime for the sake of committing the crime. Not really that anyone does, but, you know, without going into so much of a discussion on that. I believe that's what the PPI meant by this. The PPI offers a good amount of examples of just how incarceral facilities can do so, how they can actually release more people. So some things are easy. Parole boards can actually just choose to parole more people who are eligible to be paroled. They can make parole reviews more frequent, reduce the months-long delays between parole decisions and actual release. They can, you know, expedite the review process and so on. Some other measures might take more time or effort to do, but they're still extremely reasonable. Governors can grant partial clemency on their own for people who are close to parole eligibility, for example, to increase the amount of people available for review. On a larger scale, facilities could increase their rewards for good behavior, which include formulas that reduce time spent in prison overall. Or they could follow the examples of other nations, in which people in power, you know, for example, here, let's say governors, governors could choose to just let people out of prisons temporarily if they're experiencing trepidation of commuting sentences entirely. So if you absolutely don't want to release people completely, you can just release them temporarily. Judges could resentence people to make them parole-eligible or just revise their sentence length entirely. And finally, the PPI mentions that agencies that do not directly control the prison system but do drive a large population into them, like ICE and the U.S. Marshals Service, can choose to not send detainees to such facilities in the first place. And these kinds of plans are way more in detail than is reported on directly in PPI's article, or that I'm even talking about here. There are links in that article to plans that, in their summarized forms, are dozens of pages long, and that's because they've been very thoroughly written in order to make sure that everyone is as safe as can be, not just in terms of the virus, but in terms of society as a whole. What I mean is, these documents are not just a paragraph that says, well, release everyone and let's call it a day and go home. There's a lot of thought that goes into these documents, into these plans, and yet, unfortunately, it seems like most of them are going completely or mostly ignored. So the last few points that the PPI makes cover some fairly simple but impactful changes. So because they're so simple, we're not going to go over them too much. But just for some examples, they bring up reducing face-to-face contact for, quote, justice-involved people, for example. This could be things like reducing the number of people on probation and parole rolls, postponing court sessions, canceling pretrial meetings, court-ordered classes, or reducing all these, reducing collections of court debt, and so on and so forth. They also actually make an interesting warning. They warn that courts should definitely be reluctant to do court sessions in video format at all. I think that they make a very interesting point about this. So what they say is that courts should never consider detaining someone that they do not feel comfortable, for public health reasons, having in their courtroom, right? And this is because if you think that there's a health risk to them being in the same courtroom together, then if you send them to a prison or a jail with how tightly packed they are and how bad conditions in general are, you're essentially condemning many magnitudes more to suffer the infection while you're essentially just too cowardly to do so yourself. What this means is basically just put your money where your mouth is. If you care about public health, then act like you do so. If you are worried about your health because you don't want to have in-person court cases, then don't send people to, you know, prisons or jails as a result of these video court cases. You know, basically just don't care about just your health. And on this front, medical care should be made both more available and less expensive for those who are incarcerated, along with managing the numbers of cases so that levels of medical care can keep up with them. Ways to do this would be to eliminate medical copays, you know, with the state covering this instead if payment is necessary, or the federal government if it's federal prison. Things like making sure that prison staff have enough paid sick leave and encouraging them to stay home regardless, you know, even if they're out of sick leave, if they are sick during this time. And so we just talked about all these policy changes, and the next question is, well, what are people actually doing from these recommendations? And the answer is, well, unfortunately, they're not doing much. The PPI constantly updates their virus response change page with the latest changes in policies that will affect prison populations and their interactions with the virus. The current subheading to their article is that they're still monitoring the news for policy changes, but reports of them are becoming much less frequent. So basically, policy changes are pretty infrequent now, despite what you've just heard about all the numbers increasing and all that. And if you look for the most recent updates in general, you see pretty small things. You know, you see things like a few hundred people had their sentences commuted in certain states. And again, like, any number is great, right? And this is definitely a huge deal for those whose sentences were commuted. But when you see numbers that we talked about earlier, like 600,000 people normally get out each year, you can see just how relatively small these actions are on a meaningful scale. You know, it's just a few hundred. Is what is that in comparison to 600,000 people who would just get out normally? You're really not bumping up the rate by that much. And so people in prisons of power, you know, not just those directly in or attached to prison facilities, but including those like governors and legislatures as well, need to do way more on this front. Adopting even some of these reforms would go a long way to curbing a crisis that has only gotten worse compared to the first wave and shows no signs of stopping. So with that note, somewhat somber, that'll be our show for today. As always, questions, comments, concerns, you can email prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com. Stay safe, and I'll talk to you next time.